The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And I'm your host, Soraya, as always. And with us this week, we have Alex, and I don't want to butcher your last name, so why don't you tell us what it is?
It's Sakaris.
Sakaris. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, you would have had it.
I just didn't want to, you know, get it wrong. And Alex, you're out in California at the moment, right?
I am, yeah. We're outside of San Diego.
Okay, and you do your own podcast called Skeptico.
Yes, Skeptico.
With a K.
Skeptico with a K. My road led to Skeptico, so, yeah.
All right, and how long have you been doing that?
Oh, about 6 years.
Okay, why the K instead of a C?
Well, you know, the original Skepticos were these group of guys, Greek philosophers, that questioned everything and worked really hard to never come to any conclusions, but just kept searching for the questions. So the original way it's spelled is with a K, so there you go.
Nice.
Skepticos.
Nice. And I think it would be great if more skeptics actually kept to that idea rather than just being debunkers.
Well, it is kind of hard because they have co-opted that word, haven't they?
And yeah.
It has a definite meaning that's different from the original meaning. And I sometimes get into that with people. Well, you know, what's a true skeptic? And, you know, you're not a skeptic and all that stuff. So it's a funny world we live in.
It seems like skeptic a lot of times nowadays, not always, but a lot of times means you toe the mainstream line.
Oh, that's so true, Soraya. You know, and that's one of the things that really was a surprise for me as I got down this journey that I was on of exploring just controversial science, because that's how I started. I was just curious, as I'm sure we would have a similar story in that regard. I don't know exactly how you started your investigation or your interest in this topic, but mine was just out of a curiosity, like, hey, you know what? This doesn't seem to all make sense to me. These people on this side seem to have some pretty important accounts that we should be looking into, and why are these people, they seem to be dismissing it without really looking at it all the way. Let me hear both sides and make up my own mind. So that's where I started from. And I fully expected a real debate, a debate on the science, a debate on the facts. And I really didn't find that with the skeptics. I was surprised to find them really lacking. I mean, kind of swimming in the shallow end of the pool, more or less. They do really good with the fundamentalist Christian types, and those folks make them look like shining stars. But when you get past that and you get into really some of the more hardcore science, they don't do so well.
You know, I also find that there are some people out there who can't understand how you can be, say, spiritual without being religious. And to me, they're very different things.
Yes. Well, I think, and, you know, I've gotten in a little bit of hot water, if you will, on my show, because I kind of am no holds barred on the religious front either, in that, you know, I think we really have to dig into that with the best tools that we have, you know, archaeology, history, and just reason and common sense, and say, does that story, does that narrative really make sense? And how does some of this stuff that we explore about consciousness, what does that say about some of these religious beliefs? You know, we've spent quite a bit of time looking at near-death experience, and I've been lucky. I've had on my show probably five or six of the top near-death experience researchers in the world. I mean, real researchers, PhDs, MDs, smart folks who've published in peer-reviewed journals, done the right work. And I got to tell you, when you take that data and you try and put it through some of these religious prisms, and you confront some of these religious folks with it. I mean, I had a great interview with a guy I really like, Gary Habermas, written over 30 books, Christian scholar, and teaches at a major Christian university. And here's a guy who's familiar with this near-death experience science, which I'm sure so many of your listeners there are familiar with as well. But it really provides very, very compelling data suggesting that consciousness does survive death. So I put this to my Christian buddy, Gary Habermas, and he was willing to go, it was predictable, he was willing to go up to the point of saying, gee, that does seem to be suggestive that science has it wrong and that we do survive death, but I'm not willing to accept the rest of it, which suggests that, hey, you know, we might have other lives and we have these other things that conflict with Christian dogma. So, you know, this is tough, this road that we try and walk, and I think you're walking it the same way from the bit I've been exposed to your show, which I really like, by the way.
Well, thank
but,
you.
You know, when you let everybody on the table, it's kind of no holds barred, and a lot of people kind of get their nose turned a little bit if they're not willing to totally be open to wherever the data leads, and that's where I think you have to go.
And that's it exactly. I mean, you can't just ignore that which you don't like, that doesn't fit your belief system, not if you're being honest with yourself anyway.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, if you want to get into, you want to talk about the occult or you want to talk about UFOs, abduction, all that stuff, I've been amazed that as you get into some of those other areas, because they touch on consciousness as well, you see some of these same kind of debates where it seems kind of goofy to me. This is maybe way off subject. I don't know if you want to go there, but in the UFO field, I don't understand the nuts and bolts people.
Yeah,
me neither. I don't understand the idea that says, yes, I accept these accounts that seem to be from very reliable witnesses, many times multi-sourced. Many times we have, you know, we all know the story, but we have the radar, we have the observation from the air, we have the observation from the ground. We go, okay, that happened. But I'm not willing to accept that anyone had contact with them. I mean, well, wait a minute. Now, in what kind of logical framework does that make sense, that I accept that the best evidence leads me to the idea that there is some kind of visitation from that, but no one's ever encountered them? I mean, I don't know how you really reconcile that kind of thing. I think it's just shutting down, and that's what I found happens with the scientism, materialism, atheism types, is they get to a point where it just so rocks their world that they just shut down.
Now when you say people haven't encountered them, but people have encountered UFO occupants.
Exactly, and I guess I didn't make myself clear. I don't know how the nuts and bolts part of the UFO community closes themselves down sometimes to the possibility, not the possibility, the reality that people seem to be encountering these beings, and they seem to be having this extended consciousness connection with them. That gets into that really crosses over to a lot of these spiritual experiences that a lot of people are talking about. I don't have any conclusions on that. I'm not saying that I have any of the answers. I'm just saying, as we were both kind of relating about, you know, you start following the data and it starts leading you in a lot of places that if you're not willing to really be open to, you do start going, wow, you know, this is starting to get even too weird, even for me. You know?
And I think the UFO field in particular is that way. I mean, I think most people, especially if you got into it years ago, initially looked at it as a nuts and bolts thing. But myself, when I started reading John Keel and Jacques Vallée, and they made such good points as to why the nuts and bolts theories didn't work.
Right.
And then I started seeing more and more and went, yeah, this, none of this makes sense if you look at it as a nuts and bolts thing, but I can't give you an answer as to what it is exactly not accepting the nuts and bolts idea.
You know, but one thing I'd interject, and I don't want to get too far into inside baseball, so pull me back, because you and I could have like this probably in-depth conversation that may not be relatable to a lot of people. But, you know, Jacques Vallée, I was just watching the other day a presentation he gave just a couple years ago in Dubai. You know, they must have paid him and and who else was there? Stanton Friedman, and they had a couple other, you know, just big, big name guys. And it was interesting to note that Valet was very up to date on the nuts and bolts kind of thing, you know, mm-hmm. on some of that phenomena. So I think sometimes I hear people in the UFO community have kind of, I think, misunderstood some of what Valet is saying. And not that he has it all right either. But,
no.
I mean, I think it's a broad spectrum that he's looking at. So, yes, we have to look at, you know, physical phenomena, and we have to look at, you know, spiritual phenomena and or extended consciousness phenomena. And again, as you just alluded to, I think, a minute ago, we can't pretend or expect to have it all fit together in a nice, neat box, because that's what I think the investigation of extended consciousness really takes us, is that the further we go, the further we have to give up our belief that it is all going to make sense to us, because it looks more and more like we're kind of down here, and there's this larger, more, in a hierarchical sense, larger, greater consciousness that can't maybe be jammed down into our itty-bitty little brain, you know? I mean, that's the way it looks over and over again.
Yeah, I can see that. The thing is, the more you look at the UFO phenomenon, the weirder it gets. Like, if you don't exclude data, you get the high strangeness accounts that are just so weird, so out there, that you're going, okay, if this is real, it really just throws everything out the window.
Right.
And then you have to look at things like consciousness. What's happening to someone in that consciousness realm, as opposed to a material realm? That then it starts to possibly fit in a little bit better.
Right. And, you know, just to bring it down, maybe to ground it for people in a way that they can understand it, because sometimes when you throw out this consciousness thing, people are like, what do you mean consciousness? You mean like consciousness and subconsciousness? And it's like, well, and what I think you're alluding to is, take this near-death experience phenomena again. So the way it's typically studied is, or I shouldn't say typically studied, because it's studied across the board. The phenomenon happens all over the place. People will have a drowning and they may have a near-death experience. Or they may be on a plane and just be very afraid that the plane is going to go down and they might have this near-death
right.
experience. But the way that it's typically studied scientifically, academically, is in cardiac arrest wards.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is because we can eliminate or control to a certain extent the physiology of the patient. In other words, if I were to have cardiac arrest right now, we know that within 10 to 15 seconds, my brain is flatlined. And sometimes you'll hear skeptics and they'll kind of want to wrestle that point. It's like, no, you know, just go. I had to go and interview a world-renowned EEG expert, and he said, yeah, of course. And we've done all these medical experiments, both with animals and humans. Yes, that's what happens when your heart stops. 10 to 15 seconds later, your brain is flatline EEG. Well, in that state, we have no way of explaining how you could have any memory formation, how you could have any conscious experience, how you could have any experience when your brain is flatlined. And yet, consistently, over and over again, across culture, across time, that's what we're hearing, is that people, after their brain is severely, severely compromised, are having this conscious experience. Now, to bring it back to what we were just talking about, Soraya, as it relates to this high strangeness. So you go, oh, wow, that's mind-blowing. People have near-death experience. Tell us what their experience was, because that's what everyone wants to know, right? It's like, was it heaven? What was it like? You know, and there's some of that. But the kind of dirty little secret is, when you really dig into those accounts, they're all over the place.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of high strangeness. There's this guy flying on the wing of a butterfly and seeing it from this perspective, and this other guy is, you know, it's none of that. It's just this vast geometric shape that's spinning around and doing that. And one guy's meeting Jesus, and one woman over here is meeting Buddha, even though she was Christian. It's just as strange as you could possibly imagine. So those are the kind of things I think that you and I are talking about, in terms of when you get into extended human consciousness. And it's not just near-death experience. It's all other kinds of experiences. Hey, it's, you know, somebody has a Kundalini experience, you know, or somebody has a psychedelic experience. You know, they, the people that go and do ayahuasca or, you know, other psychoactive drugs, you know, again, there's just a wide variety of experiences in this extended consciousness realm that it, we can't boil it all down and say, oh, this is what it means. It just becomes very strange, right? Isn't that what we're kind of, you're saying too?
Yeah, in a sense, yeah. And what I find interesting about the near-death experiences too is not just what the person experiences, like, you know, when they move toward the light, they have their life review and all that type of stuff. But what really is striking to me is when they can describe what's going on in the room or in the room next to them, and they can do so in such detail that they couldn't have been able to do it unless they could see what was going on. And I know there were some, there was at least one doctor who had done research. He was a heart doctor, and I can't remember his name for the life of me. But he did.
Is it Pim van Lommel, the guy in the Netherlands?
I don't know. It might have been. But he did a control. So he gave every patient he had a questionnaire, whether they had a near-death experience or not. And they found the people who didn't have near-death experiences were so far off on what they thought was going on during the experience, you know, during the surgery, whereas the people who were having near-death experiences and could see down into the room were dead on, down to little details they couldn't possibly have known.
Yeah, that's, you know, one of the, there's actually a couple people that have done that work, and one of them is Dr. Penny Sartori in the UK, and I've actually had her on Skeptico, and she's a great guest, and really a very, very nice person, a bright person, very smart. But you're exactly right. And just to clarify for people, typically when people have this near-death experience in hospital, in a cardiac arrest ward, and really in general, you can say this, there's almost two phases of it. And the first phase is, as you just alluded to, this out-of-body experience, this feeling and sensation, and as far as we can tell from the evidence, like you're alluding to, a real experience of being outside of their body and observing the surroundings. And then they move to this other dimension, this other realm, if you will, where all this really crazy stuff happens. But in that first part, they have done some fascinating experiments, and one that I think I've just touched on so many times because it's the one that you just mentioned, is they said, okay, look, the resuscitation process, you know, when they're pounded on the chest and maybe giving them the electrodes and stuff like that. Now, keep in mind, in hospital today, and this is confirmed by one of the top cardiologists in the world, a guy named Dr. Pim van Lommel, but anyone who's in that, he's studied it in depth, but anyone who's in that situation will tell you, that resuscitation process doesn't happen at least 1 minute, typically 2 minutes after that person's heart has stopped. So again, there is no chance that there is any brain activity during that resuscitation process, okay? So what they did is exactly what you said. They said, let's use that as the point at which we're going to measure how accurately people can bring back this evidential information and see if they can tell us what the resuscitation was like, you know, and they'll say what color the paddles were on the cart or what color the cart was or, you know, all this stuff. And what they found is that the people who did not have a near-death experience, and they said, well, I didn't have a near-death experience. I didn't see anything. And they say, okay, anyway, tell me what you think happened during resuscitation. And they go, okay, yeah, I'll tell you what I think happened. And they'll recount, you know, more or less like what they saw on the TV show, and It's not at all accurate. And then they'll ask that same question, that series of questions, to people who do report having a near-death experience, and they're significantly, again, this is peer-reviewed stuff, so they do good science, they do good statistics, they come up with good measures, and it's highly more accurate, in a statistically significant way, it's much more likely that they're able to recall their resuscitation event than people who did not have a near-death experience. It's very compelling research, and not talked about enough either.
And I know there are some places, I think it was in the UK, it might be in the US as well, where they had put way up on top of the ceiling. They would put signs that they wanted to see if people could read. And I don't think anyone's ever read them, but I also wonder if that's because that's not something they're focusing on.
Well, the guy who did that, and he's still doing that research, is a gentleman named Dr. Sam Parnia. And he's, again, quite a brilliant guy. And he's was with Cornell and is now with another university. I think in a university out there in New York, actually.
Well, we're like 2 minutes from Cornell.
Ah, that's where he used to practice, and he actually started this work. It's called the AWARE Project. He started it there. Hmm. He's been on Skeptico. You can listen to the interview with him. I gave him a pretty hard time on this exact point because he started this research with Dr. Penny Sartori and Dr. Peter Fenwick, both in the UK, and they're still colleagues. And he's a great guy, Sam Parnia. He really is, and he's done brilliant research. Very, very smart guy. But the problem with that is, and you see this so many times with science that rubs people the wrong way, that is controversial science, and that is they try and appease this skeptical element. Because as we were chatting about a little bit before we went on the air, you know, the real point with skeptics is not the skeptic, you know, the people who make a lot of noise and go to these crazy conferences and are self-identified skeptics. What they really serve, they're the tip of the spear for a scientific community that really wants things to stay the way they are. And in particular, they have a strong vested interest in this mind equals brain. You are a biological robot. Your consciousness is an illusion. That's the standard line, and they want to hold to it. So I think a lot of times what folks wind up doing, and I think this happened to Dr. Parnia a little bit, is designing these quote-unquote ironclad experiments that can get, you know, will finally put us over the edge. And what they don't realize is that's not the game. You're never going to get enough evidence. And here's the problem with the AWARE study. Right off the bat, if you say you're going to be in a near-death scenario and you're going to put objects up on the ceiling, which is what they did. They basically, if you imagine a light that's suspended from the ceiling, we're going to put it on the top of the light so that no one down here can see it. But if you're floating up on the top of the room, then you could see it. Mm-hmm. Well, the problem with that is you have to go no further than read the near-death experience accounts, the accounts from these people. They don't always float up above their body. Sometimes they're to the side of the body. Sometimes they're down, at the feet of the body. They're just sometimes not in position to see that. So from that standpoint, it doesn't work. But then if you go further and you ask these people what their experience was like, what they observed, what they didn't observe, there's really no guarantee that they would observe these kind of things. It's more or less, as near as we can tell, it's more or less like our consciousness, you know? If you walked into my office or I walked into your studio and then I walked out, you know, 5 seconds later, you don't know what I would pick up, you know? I could be able to tell you some of the things about there, but you don't know where my attention would have been drawn. And it seems to be the same case for these people who've had these near-death experiences. So Dr. Parnia has done this research, and this has not been the sole focus of the research. He hasn't only limited himself to the objects on the ceiling. And I think as he's talked more about this research as he's developed, he's found a lot of very, very important discoveries in doing this research. But I don't think that's going to be one of the things that's going to come out of it is a significant number of people will say, yeah, I was floating up on the ceiling and I saw the sign up there and here's what it said. You know?
Yeah, I think there's more important issues to you when you find yourself looking down at your own body.
Yeah. But, you know, even that, it's tricky because you would think that would be true, Sarai, but not necessarily. I mean, people seem to be picking up kind of mundane things in this mode, you know. But it does seem more or less to parallel our own, you know, consciousness. Again, if you walk through my office and you came out the other end and you go, you know, I noticed that weird lamp you had over there of like a robot thing. That's the thing you picked up on. I mean, who knows why that's what drew your attention, you know, but that's the way we are, right? I mean,
sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, now Sam Parney, is he the one who was also trying to do resuscitations from like someone who's been dead for an hour or something like that?
I'm sorry, you broke up a little bit on there. The Skype must have dropped.
Dr. Parnia, he's the one that was trying to resuscitate people from like longer terms of death?
Yeah, well, he is a world-renowned expert in resuscitation. And I think that, what's really interesting about his work is he really starts at, well, I was going to say he starts at the beginning, but he really starts at the end. He starts at, you know, what is death? And how that understanding we have of death, even in a conventional sense, has been dramatically redefined in our lifetime. You know, it's easy to forget that this idea of resuscitating, at least to the scale that we do it now in terms of bringing people back, is really a rather recent phenomenon. You know, I mean, it's been around for, you know, 30, 40 years, but
right.
It's really rather recent. So it creates a lot of questions, a lot of research questions, a lot of moral, ethical questions. And to his credit, he's someone who's really tried to put his arms around the whole thing and some of those larger questions. So he's quite an interesting guy to investigate, Dr. Sam Parnia.
Okay. One of the things that always strikes me about near-death experiences is, why do you think it is that not everyone has them?
Again, I point to Parnia because he's done some really interesting work on that. And one of the conclusions, his evidence seems to point towards it's more a function of memory. Hmm. And again, it would relate back to this point of, you know, we shouldn't be too enamored with our little mind brain thing that we have going on here in this planet, because it is flawed and it seems to be not so perfect even in these extraordinary situations. So what he's found that points in that direction is that if they can get to people very quickly after they come to, after they've recovered from their cardiac arrest, the incidence of near-death experience recall shoots up dramatically.
Hmm. And I always wondered that. I wondered if it was kind of like a dream, where a dream is an altered state of consciousness. You come back, it doesn't always stick with you.
Exactly. Exactly. I have the exact same thought, and I think the parallel there is meaningful and it's important. And I think it also relates in a way, you know, a discovery that I kind of stumbled across is, you know, the whole phenomena of lucid dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever had a lucid dream?
All the time.
Oh, see, that's pretty cool. Now that suggests that you have some, maybe that you're open to some of this extended human consciousness thing. So have you had a lot of paranormal experiences?
Yeah, quite a lot.
Okay. All right. See, there you go. Well, there's a high correlation there, right? A lot of people who have this ability to lucid dream have psychic abilities, have you know, this ability sometimes to leave their body and do these other things. Mm-hmm. And for folks who don't know, and your listeners probably do, a lucid dream is nothing more than having a dream and being aware in the dream that you're dreaming. And you kind of have this observer-object relationship where you can make your dream kind of do what you want it to do. And what I've discovered in my investigation on this, and now I have a lucid dreamer that I'm talking to here, so I can bounce this idea off of you and we'll see what you think.
Okay.
But I think the function of lucid dreaming has more to do with memory than it has to do with a different kind of dream, in that I think a lot of our dreams are lucid dreams, but we're just not, we don't have the memory to remember that the dream was lucid, to remember that we were in somewhat of a bit of control. Because the other thing about lucid dreams, and you back me up on this, there's a degree, and some of the dreams, because I've had a few lucid dreams, more than a few, but not probably as regular as you, but Some of the dreams are incredibly lucid, you know, where you're totally in control.
Yeah.
Some of the dreams less so, where there's an awareness of that, that it's a dream, and you kind of see things happening as you think about them, then they happen in your dream. And what I've discovered, and through talking to other people, is that part of that process is then just remembering that that process was occurring. Because sometimes, I know for myself, I'll remember the dream, and then I'll remember, if I do it right away, that I was controlling to a certain extent that dream moved. You know,
and I've also had dreams that started out as perfectly normal dreams, and then let's say I die. And when I die, I suddenly take over as a lucid dream and went, well, that sucked. I'm going to go back to before I died and choose a different option. So it just becomes lucid at that point.
Yes, yes. So. Which, again, relates back to our conversation when we were saying about how high strangeness, you know. It's when we start dealing with these fringes of what we understand about consciousness, it forces us to kind of be open or shut down to a lot of stuff that's just out there and is compelling in terms of its evidence.
What do you think about the idea that DMT is part of the, what's causing these near-death experiences?
Well, there's just no evidence for it. They've investigated it thoroughly. Probably the guy who's looked at it more conclusively than anyone else is Dr. Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia. There's just no evidence for it.
I thought there had been a study that showed there was a release of DMT.
Oh, well, I think that there's that may be the case. They have the way that the skeptical mainstream science community has attacked the larger phenomena of near-death experience is to, again, it's a familiar strategy, but it's kind of the divide and conquer thing, you know. So they'll kind of chip this part away, and they'll say, oh, you know, look, the one that just hit recently that relates a little bit to the DMT thing, not directly but indirectly, is a guy, I forget where he was, this researcher discovered an electrical discharge in the brain when the neurons actually died. And they had it, and they discovered it in rats. And I had a gentleman on in the show, Dr. Lakhmer Chawla, who discovered it in human beings. And it caused quite a stir, and, you know, it gets trumpeted by the skeptical scientific media, and it's just, you'll see it everywhere, you know. You see it, National Geographic, NBC, all the things. That now, one might ask, based on our conversation, well, gee, that's wonderful. How does that explain someone being outside of their body, hearing a conversation down the hall? Well, it doesn't. How does it explain the continuity of experience, right? So these near-death experiencers will tell you, oh, I remember being shot and stabbed. Then I was outside of my body as I was in the ambulance driving, and it was really weird because I was above my body as they wheeled me in, and then they started resuscitating me, and then I went up and traveled, you know, da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. Now, how would you jam that back into a five-second discharge of electrical activity of a dying brain? It's absolutely silly. It's just ridiculous. And why someone would advance that without that it'd just be, it's such a ridiculous claim. But yet, you know, there it is. There you have it. Same is true with the release of DMT. You have this continuity of experience for these people. A lot of times it's going on for, you know, a half hour. And it's before, you know, if we open it up to the larger experience, not just cardiac arrest. Like the account that I told you is one that I investigated. This woman actually interviewed her. You know, stabbed, shot and stabbed. She's conscious and she's bleeding. She's not dead, but she's now outside of her body. Right. You know? Okay, so this whole thing is happening and she's on the way to the hospital. Again, this, all we need is one case, right, Soraya? It's the black swan thing.
Yep.
All we need is one case. So you have to explain DMT fitting into that scenario and explaining that scenario, or that theory has to be thrown aside. And what you'll hear skeptics say, and I interviewed Dr. Steve Novella, Yale University neurologist, you know, just hardcore skeptic, and it's just, it's brutal how silly these arguments are. But what he'll tell you is, hey, you know what? What we're finding is that it's a variety of different things that are happening. Well, that's craziness. No. I mean, you can't say in this case it was DMT. In this case, it was deprivation of the brain. In this case, it was deep brain activity. When what really is amazing about the phenomena is how it seems to be uniform across all these different physiologically different conditions. So one person was just in a plane. Nothing was wrong with them. They weren't stabbed. Nothing happened to them. The other person was drowning. The other person was shot. Right. And they all have the same experience. Now, you can't start picking that apart and saying, yeah, but the way to explain it is with, you know, this kaleidoscope of different possible explanations. Again, like I say, when you push the skeptics, it's unbelievably ridiculous. It's just intellectually bankrupt. It's so pathetic, their explanations.
I also think that the out-of-body state is the hardest one to explain with those type of things. I mean, you can say a massive release of DMT might alter your sense of time. So you might think your experience was an hour long, but it's only 2 minutes long. But that out of body state can't be explained by a release of DMT unless the DMT is somehow assisting you in getting out of your body. In which case, that the rest of that experience is more likely to be a genuine experience.
Yeah, and even that, I mean, you know, if we're going to accept out of body experience, I don't care whether you want to attach DMT to it or hypoxia or whatever kind of, we've already blown away everything we know about neuroscience. We don't have a way of explaining how you can be quote unquote out of your body.
Yeah.
We don't have a way of explaining how you can hear without your ears, how you can see without your eyes. We have people whose ears are taped up, closed, you know, as part of their medical condition. Mm-hmm. We have people that are blind from birth, who've never seen, who have a near-death experience and are able to see for the first time. Now, forget about everything else. Forget about going to heaven or any of these other terms or ideas that might throw you off. Just explain that.
Yeah.
And if you can't explain that, then you have to confront the biggest step. Because, you know, when we talk about extended human consciousness like we were, and when we talk about how that, you know, gets a little bit fuzzy and there's all these different accounts, hey, that to me is the other side of the chasm. The side of the chasm we're on right now is we're stuck in scientific materialism. We're stuck in a world where kids who go to school learn the idea that they are a biological robot, that they have no real conscious experience. That's an illusion, that there is no meaning to their life because there's no meaning in the universe. That is status quo science. Mm-hmm. So the big step is just jumping on the other side and saying, okay, well, that we know is wrong. Because we do. We know that's wrong. Scientific materialism has been falsified, right? So when we jump over on the other side, now, you know, where does the road go? I don't know, because there's a lot of different places it can take us. But we have a much better chance of getting there on that other side of the chasm. Because over here, scientific materialism, consciousness is an illusion of a biological robot. We have no chance. Yeah. The road is dead ended. You know, I mean, it's at the end.
All right. We got to take a quick 45-second break. We'll be right back with Alex Sakaris.
Perfect.
All right.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we're talking tonight with Alex Sekiris of Skeptico, and that's with a K. And it is an excellent podcast that deals with all manner of things relating to consciousness. And you still there, Alex?
Sure am, Sarai, right. Yes.
You know, there have been two books over the years that really just kind of altered the way I viewed things. And the first one was Kenneth Ring's Omega Project, which I'm guessing right. You're probably familiar with.
Right, right. Based kind of on a, maybe not as familiar as you are, but certainly familiar with it.
Well, he compared people who had UFO experiences and people who had near-death experiences.
Right.
And found an amazing amount of similarities in the after effects. Mm-hmm. And also compared it, of course, to a control group that didn't have any of these experiences and found that they were very, very different, that there was something definitely going on. These people were having a life-changing experience. And even though on the surface it looked like a different experience, it was having the same after effects. And that threw me because at the time I was still looking at UFOs as a material, nuts and bolts, extraterrestrial sort of thing. And looking at that, it's like, well, how is that possible? How could it be material and have the same after effects as a near-death experience?
It's an interesting question, an interesting area. I don't know if you're aware of this, but I did a series of interviews recently with UFO abduction researcher Dr. David Jacobs and UFO abduction researcher Mary Rodwell, mm-hmm. who is... in Australia, right. has done a lot of hypnotic regressions in the same way that Dr. Jacobs has. And to a certain extent, I was drilling into some of the same questions that you have. And that is, how are we to understand the abduction experience? In particular, the fact that a lot of people are saying that it is transformative spiritually.
Right.
And we have this other camp represented by Dr. David Jacobs, who says, no, you're fooling yourself. That's the old John Mack, former Harvard yeah. University psychologist who back in the 90s, you know, started investigating this, and through his very substantial credentials and reputation, and here's a Pulitzer Prize winner saying, wow, I've investigated this. This is not crazy. I thought I should just be able to dismiss this out of hand, but as everything I know as a psychiatrist tells me that these people have had a traumatic experience, and I have to take their experience at face value. So anyways, here we have these two camps. We have this one camp saying these are transformative spiritual experiences, and that we should look at them the way that Dr. Ring is talking about, as how do they relate to near-death experiences? How do they relate to other transformative spiritual experiences, be mm-hmm. they, you know, religious or whatever? And then you got this other camp who says, no, you have to look at these as abductions, as, you know, criminal deeds carried out by these others who have this desire to control and have this agenda, which we can't fully understand, but we should be very leery of. So I spent quite a few shows on that, and I don't know, before I say too much more, where do you come down on that, Sarai? Do you have any clear...
Yeah, I think even the negative experiences eventually resolve themselves into more positive ones as long as you don't fight them. I don't think they are exactly what they seem. I did hear the latest shows you did with both Jacobs and Barry. Don't really agree with either of them. I have a lot of issues, actually, with the way David Jacobs conducts his work, because he's so sure he is right about everything and he knows exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
That I think he's doing more damage to these people.
Well, I understand where you're coming from there. Here's the razor's edge that I walk on, because it's tough, you know, maybe that's a bad analogy, because I can get pulled either way, you know. I look at Mary Rodwell and the spiritually transformative experience and kind of what you alluded to. It's all good, you know, it just depends on what you need and it gives you that. It's like, you know, maybe. But if I look at the near-death experience as a model of this extended human consciousness, and in some ways it's a good model because we have taken the brain out of the equation, you know.
Yeah.
In these other models, like a Kundalini model, or you have some other kind of, you know, or a psychedelic experience, ayahuasca experience, your brain is still in there, you know, co-pilot on this thing. Mm-hmm. Near-death experience, not so much, you know, we can't really go there. And my point is that the near-death experience, you don't see the coercion like you clearly do in some of the abduction accounts.
Yeah.
You don't see some of the other just kind of creepy stuff that's happening that, you know, even if you say, oh, it's all for your own good or it resolves itself eventually, there's definitely a difference there. There's a different tone. And I don't know how it all fits together. I don't know if there's a hierarchy and some of these abduction experiences are from beings or consciousness thingies that are somewhere between the higher consciousness, and they're just kind of like the medium consciousness, and they're a lot. I kind of lean towards the working hypothesis that they're a lot more like us than we sometimes think.
Oh, sure.
And that maybe they're not as spiritually advanced as we might like to think, or maybe even as technologically advanced. I mean, who's to say they're, you know, that far ahead? I mean, they may just be a couple of hop, skips, and jumps along the road.
Well, the thing is, in my experiences, I had a lot of paranormal type experiences, and some of them initially were very negative experiences, but I learned an enormous amount, and they changed me in a very positive way afterwards. So when I look back now, I say, yeah, that was a horrible experience to go through, but I grew such an enormous amount from it. The other thing I realized at some point was that they mimicked UFO abduction accounts, even though UFOs weren't involved, even though there were no grays, it was a different type of experience, but the archetype was the same, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and, no, it's very interesting.
And so that, you know, that changed my view of the whole thing, and that was also why I started pushing so far away from the nuts and bolts idea of UFOs, that these aren't aliens, they're not physical, they're something else. And I can't say what they are, I just know that from all my experiences, both positive and negative, I look back on it all and say, well, in the end, it was all a positive experience. They were all growing experiences.
Yeah, I hear you.
So I think outlook is part of it. I think it's a big part of it, because I think sometimes this gives you back what you expect.
Yeah, and or what you need or whatever. Yeah, it all gets very spiritual very quick, too, you know, which is the other thing that makes people feel uncomfortable, because you do have to jam it into some kind of spiritual framework, because our ordinary understanding of how things are and how things operate is blown away. So,
yeah. What do you think of Jane Roberts?
Refresh my memory.
The Seth material.
Oh, the Seth material. You know, it's interesting. Intriguing, it's inspiring. At the same time, I'm just really leery of channeled work. I don't know what the vehicle is. I know some of it is phenomenal. I know some of it doesn't seem to be a very high quality. I just haven't gone there because of that. I like to stick to stuff that can be investigated scientifically, because really at the end of the day, the tools and methods of science, we may just be playing a game. Hey, scratch that. We are playing a game. You know, we're playing this little consensus reality game, because as we say, we know it's not really like this. It's not real in the way we think it's real. Science, you know, basic science is telling us that. Quantum physics says that conclusively. And you've all heard it so many times. You know, your desk is not your desk. I'm pounding on my desk. It's 99.99999% nothing. Yep. How is there anything there? We don't understand it. You know, all that stuff. So, but we play this game and we play it hard, the consensus reality game, that we really have a desk, that we really have these, you know, we can make sense, we have this logic, and we have this reason. And if we're going to play that game, the best tools we have are these methods of science, of investigation, that allows us to remove ourselves from our bias. I don't know how you get there with channeled material. I think it's a lot more difficult. I think, and I also think, as I alluded to before, hey, the big step for me, and the step that I like to revisit for myself and also for the people who listen to Skeptico, is that leap across the chasm from materialism, from, you know, science, status quo, to what lies beyond. And I think then I'm open to, yeah, I'm open to Seth. I'm open to hearing, you know, that. I'm open to, you know, people who talk to God or talk to Jesus, talk to all that stuff. I want to hear all that. But I do, there's a side of me, the skeptical side of me, that wants to bring it back and say, okay, but now let's play this other game here. Let's compare that to archaeology. Let's compare that to history. Right, let's compare that to all this other stuff.
Well, and here's the thing. I feel the same way about channeling, even more so in the past than I do now. But I literally picked up a Seth book for like a buck at some used bookstore. And I thought, well, this will be good for a laugh at some point, because I just really had no respect for channeling whatsoever. And for the most part, I still don't. I find a lot of it to be very empty. It sounds nice, but it doesn't really have any substantial data to it. And I was researching near-death experiences, probably late 90s or so, and I kept seeing these pages that would be filled with scientific data followed by mentioning Seth. And I was like, why is it always Seth? And so I finally picked up the book and read through it and was actually pretty astounded by the amount of detail that was in the book. It wasn't like other channeled material. And one of the things Seth talks about is what happens when you die. And he talks about how some people, when they die, they stick with their body. And other people, before they're dead, actually leave their body. And this came right on the tail of looking at near-death research, where they were saying, well, the same heart doctor was saying, well, you know, some people were having near-death experiences who didn't die, but other people who did die didn't have near-death experiences. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Maybe yes. This Seth material actually is onto something here, because it does seem to correlate.
Oh, totally. I agree with you. And I think there's many, many, as we both know, examples of channeled material. I mean, you look at that Edgar Cayce stuff way back then. Yeah. I mean, there's just gems out of that. And there's so many. There's, what's the other one I was just thinking of a minute ago? I forget. Conversations with God, you know, was a really popular book. But you read that, it's got some amazing, brilliant, inspiring insights, you know, all channeled material. So I don't dismiss it. I just am a little bit frustrated that I can't really wrestle it to the ground. I mean, you give me an NDE study and I can say, well, gee, you know, did you compare this to this? What about this? What about this? With Seth, we don't know where the edges are. You know, we don't know what doesn't really fit.
Yeah. Well, I think in difference to a lot of channeled material, there was a lot of detail there. There was a lot of specific information, which you don't find in channeled material. And that's why the only thing that really stands out to me about it, you know, because you get so much of it, like, you know, Ramtha was what, Atlantean warrior prince or something like that. And Seth was just, you know, his incarnations were all regular people. And Jane Roberts didn't know if what she was doing was actually channeling another entity or if it was somehow coming from her subconscious. And she was very upfront about that. And I always kind of respected that.
Yeah, I've seen, you know, and anyone can check out, and I'm sure you have some of the YouTube videos, actually videotapes of her.
Yeah.
And talk about high strangeness. I mean, it's a trip, man. I mean,
it's hard for me to watch, honestly.
It is. Because it looks so freaking fake.
Yeah. Yeah,
which is, you know, the other element of this, which again throws people for a loop, in that the fakers are copying the authentic experiences, and that's why it all looks fake. And I'm not saying that Seth is authentic or not. It certainly looks authentic. I lean towards that as you do.
But I think, like, if any of them are, that's your best candidate.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, you're right. That's exactly what happens. Is they copy the genuine accounts. And that's also a thing with UFO accounts. When the UFO account seems too perfect, when the video seems too perfect, it's kind of like, okay, you know what? Most UFO accounts don't actually lay out this perfectly.
Yeah, exactly. You know, my kids are they know that I'm interested in this stuff, and they're interested in it too. Hell, everyone's interested in this stuff if they're honest about it. But when my kids will show me, you know, UFO videos on YouTube, all they have to do is take one glance, say, nope, too good, it's not real. Now you got lights, just a little dot in the sky that's, you know, juggling around there. Oh, well, you have to investigate that one because it's so crappy that it's it has the potential. It's passed the first test.
Yeah, because it's hard to shoot stuff like that in the sky. You're generally not going to get a good video. We don't have cameras that are made to shoot stuff like that. So you're going to get a shaky, blurry light, especially at night. You know, you take a picture of the moon with a normal camera and you don't see the moon. You see a blurry white light.
Right, right.
And you get the same thing if you see a UFO. And then people say, oh, those are crappy. That was just something else. And it's like, okay, what was it? You know, what moves like that?
Yeah, well, the night vision glasses have really taken that whole thing to another level. I think there's some pretty compelling stuff out there, too.
True, true. Yeah. I'm also fascinated by the stuff that picks up infrared and will pick up stuff you can't see with your naked eye.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know there's been a number of different projects done. Andrew Collins did one in his book Alien Energy where they took a lot of infrared photos and would pick up, like, stuff just floating around that you couldn't see with your naked eye. I know there was a police camera footage from a helicopter of an object following the helicopter that they couldn't see, and it was freaking them out.
Wow, I didn't see that. Yeah. See, we like the nuts and bolts stuff. We can play that game.
Well, it doesn't mean it's nuts and bolts. It's just, in fact, the fact that you can't see it actually leans away from the nuts and bolts idea.
It's true, but then again, it's not in the pure consciousness realm.
Oh, true.
Either.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I guess when I say nuts and bolts, I think extraterrestrial. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily think these things are extraterrestrial. I think they're here with us.
Mm. Well, I don't limit the possibility that they're extraterrestrial either. I mean, there's a lot of accounts that directly say that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what you do with that. Again, it's all open to being explored. But there's enough accounts that makes me kind of lean towards that being, you know, a real possibility, too.
It's certainly a possibility. I mean, but you also see a big trickster element running through it as well.
I don't know what to make of the trickster thing. I mean, I think there's some there's some of that that rings true, and then there's some of it that seems just as forced as everything else. You know, I mean, the trickster in what sense? I mean, we're all tricksters, you know? I mean, it becomes meaningless at some point. So, yeah, I don't really know how far I go with the trickster.
It seems that they will give accurate information to a point. You know, John Keel did a lot with that, too. I'm not sure how much of Keel's work you're familiar with, but...
Yeah, a little bit.
He would show that, you know, they would make predictions, and these predictions would all come true, and then suddenly they'd just stop. You know, and suddenly they'd be completely inaccurate as soon as that person started to, you know, really ride high on the fact that they were getting secret information. Suddenly they'd be given wrong information. And to me, that's a trickster type of an element, you know.
Well, I was just about to say, so we can start with the same set of facts, and then we can come to a different conclusion, is that, you know, we don't know what the end game was, what the motivation is. We know what happened, but we just don't know if that was a trickster element, if it was a disinformation element, if there was, you know, some alternative reality that played out some other way. I mean, you can get really crazy with it.
True.
I don't know. But where I'm uncomfortable with is then we start, you know, as Hansen has done, oh, we start, oh, there's been this trickster element in every culture, and you know, here they are in the Native Americans, and here they are in the Amazonian, and it's the coyote, and it's this, and it sounds like, you know, all that just starts getting a little bit tenuous in terms of these links, in terms of that relates to this. It's like, yeah, maybe, but you haven't convinced me.
Hmm. Okay. All right. That's fair. You're on WVBR FM Ithaca. This is Where the Road Go. We're talking to Alex Sakaris, at least for a couple more minutes here. And I did want to talk to you about... your dealings with some of the skeptics you've had on your show. And the one I heard was with the armchair skeptic. And if I remember right, you were going to have him on two shows. The first one, you were just going to discuss what you wanted to cover with him and then give him time to go research the data and come back and then have a debate with you on it. And he just refused to come back, didn't he?
Yeah, that was the atheist guy again. I don't remember his name,
but wasn't he the, it was something, armchair atheist or?
Not the armchair atheist. Oh gosh. We'll have to look it up.
It was one of your more recent shows.
Yeah, no, I remember the show. Yeah. I've had a lot of interviews with atheists, and I have a policy, Soraya, of anytime, anywhere kind of thing. So anyone who has written a book or two or has any kind of prominence in the atheist or skeptical community is welcome. Encouraged. If you're out there, please come. Let's dialogue. Let's converse on these topics. Atheism is silly at its core because it's built on this scientific materialism. A lot of atheists will rebel against that and say, no, we're not. We don't have any beliefs. We just believe not in God. It's like, no. What you believe is that life is meaningless, and you believe that consciousness is an illusion and that we are biological robots. The science doesn't support that. So you can go, and I've had Oxford philosopher Dr. Stephen Law, debated that with him. The debunking Christianity, John Loftus, the thinking atheist, I think is
that. That was it.
Debated him, although he just ducked. They all duck and run for cover pretty quick. But yeah, it's an interesting dynamic.
And I thought the way you set it up was completely fair by basically laying out what you wanted to talk about in one show and then giving him the time to go and research it and look this stuff up so he could mount a defense, basically, and he still didn't take you up on it.
Well, you know, it's become a running joke on my show, this idea of sandbagging my guests. I don't sandbag my guests. I always give them just a ton of material beforehand about my shows. I say, here, check out this show, check out this show. Here are some of the questions I'm going to ask. But the claim always is that, if I had a little bit of time to prepare. So I got tired of hearing this from the atheists and the skeptics. And that's when I did this with the thinking atheist guy. I said, great, please go prepare. Let's do this. I'm not even going to hit you with any of the tough stuff the first time. I'll just speck out the turf that we're going to cover next time, you know? That was my idea, to kind of overcome this idea that I didn't give people a chance to prepare. Well, as soon as I do that, people see what happens. Then they know they never come back. And they're gone and they never come back.
And then he tried to say it was a different show he thought he was going on or something.
He was sandbagged. That's what's going to be like. Well, we didn't even have the real interview. I mean, if you think you were sandbagged by just asking the prep questions, you should have come back for this round two. But had a real good time.
The something I found interesting. What's his name? Dawkins was speaking somewhere, and Graham Hancock went, and Graham asked him if he would ever try DMT, and. He said something like if he knew it could be safe, he would be interested in trying it. But no matter what happened, he would just accept it as a side effect of the brain.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it's like, so you've already made up your mind. You're not open-minded about this. You're not saying, a new experience. Let me see what I derive from this. It's I've already decided what it is, but sure, I'll try it.
Right.
But I also noticed he said he had taken place in an experiment where they used one of the helmets that generates electromagnetic waves. And he said he really hoped to experience something, and he didn't. And I wonder if some of these people just are so closed off, maybe even from a biological level, to some of these experiences that when you just don't have them, you start not believing they exist.
Well, you know, that's certainly a possibility. And some people have speculated along the kind of biological kind of path. To me, that takes us down the wrong road. And we're again now falling into the biological robot and that our biology explains who we are. And clearly it doesn't. But it clearly has an influence too. Yes, I mean, we can't deny that this brain, this pile of meat that we have up there is highly, highly
impressive,
influencing our conscious experience. There's just no two ways about that. But I think the other evidence that kind of suggests that maybe that isn't the habit is look at religious people. We know, look at the worst, the cults, the things that we fully understand and appreciate are cultish behaviors. And I've had an interview with a couple of people that are seriously investigating and helping people in cults. And you see that the mind, the brain, the mind, the worldview can really be shut down or focused in a way that is not healthy and closes you down to all logic and reason. So I don't think Dawkins is exempt from that, and I don't think a lot of people who have a strong invested ego in a particular worldview are escaped that either.
All right. Well, tell people where they can check out your show.
Well, it's skeptico.com, SKEPTIKO, as you mentioned. If you just Google Alex NDE or, you know, any of these, it's pretty easy to find. It's pretty searchable, and you'll find me if you're halfway interested in looking.
And how long have you been doing it?
6 or 7 years.
Okay. Are all your shows archived or just recent ones?
All of them out there, all of them for free, full show for free. Transcripts on 90% of them. Some of them I didn't go out there and get the transcripts done, but most of them I do.
I didn't realize that.
And I'm rolling it all into a book, too, that I'm going to...
Really? Any idea when that might come out?
Later this year. I'm not sure. I'd say I'm shooting for this summer, but I don't know.
I know how that goes. All right. Well, I thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us. And I definitely recommend people check out your podcast. It's definitely one of my favorites. And you do explore a lot of interesting stuff with a lot of interesting people.
Thank you so much, Soraya, and for the invitation and turning me on to your show. So it's now in my iPod and regular rotation, too. And you know what I love about, you know, the way you've archived your show and my show is that I can pick and choose. I mean, not all your topics fit my interests, but some of the ones you do are just, you do excellent interviews. So when the topic is something I'm interested in, I'm definitely plugging in, man. I'm churning through a lot of your old shows.
Great, great. I'm glad you're enjoying them. All right. For those listening live, The Last Exit for the Lost is up next. Thank you, Alex. And maybe we'll have you back at some point, especially after you put that book out.
Okay, you bet.
All right. Here's some Psyche Corporation to take you out.
Come in. Understand the numbers pouring over your connection. Into perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Counting. Can you hear?